This is VOA News. We are both. I'm Alex. The Russian military assault on Ukraine went into its fifth day Monday. Ukraine's ambassador to the U.S. was on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., with House and Senate lawmakers. Speaking to reporters in between two meetings, Oksana Markarova said Monday was especially difficult in her country's war with Russia. She said Russia is stepping up its attacks against Ukraine's innocent civilians and accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of using a vacuum bomb against residential areas, which she added was prohibited by the Geneva Convention. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters earlier in the day the administration can't confirm reports of Moscow's use of a vacuum bomb. But she said if it is true, it would potentially be a war crime. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Monday it was time for the West to consider imposing a no-fly zone for Russian missiles, planes, and helicopters. The actions would be in response to Russian shelling of the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. In a video address, Zelensky did not specify how and by whom a no-fly zone would be enforced. He said Russia had launched 56 rocket strikes and fired 113 cruise missiles in the past 5 days since beginning its invasion of Ukraine on February 24th. There was a tense calm in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, but explosions and gunfires were heard in embattled cities in eastern Ukraine as Russian troops met unexpected resistance. We continue to follow the latest on VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. At a U.S. news conference Monday, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby says Russia has faced strong resistance from Ukrainian fighters, but Russia retains a lot of firepower.
Mr. Putin still has at his disposal significant combat power. He hasn't moved all of it into Ukraine, but he's moved the majority of it. He still has a lot that he hasn't moved into Ukraine.
Western sanctions triggered by the invasion sent the ruble plummeting on Monday, so ordinary Russians flocked to banks and ATMs to draw out cash. Talks on the invasion of Ukraine have yielded no breakthroughs as Russian troops draw closer to Kyiv. Meanwhile, Ukraine and Western states appealed to the international community to support a draft resolution at the United Nations General Assembly condemning the Russian invasion. AP correspondent Jennifer King has more.
Pleas for peace in Ukraine dominated an emergency session at the United Nations, while hours of diplomatic talks between Ukrainian and Russian officials in Belarus ended without agreement. Both sides said they would try again soon. As blasts were heard in Kyiv, Ukraine is seeking a ceasefire and the complete withdrawal of Russian forces. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky announced he has signed Ukraine's application to join the European Union. It's a mostly symbolic act that normally takes years to achieve, and his country hasn't met the required benchmarks, but it signals a desire to draw closer to European allies. For their part, the 27-member EU bloc voted to provide aid and weapons to Ukraine, and EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell says officials have been meeting to figure out how to organize the flow of support, which they say will be coordinated with NATO.
They need the defensive purpose arms of any kind, and we are going to provide them.
I'm Jennifer King.
The General Assembly is meeting under what is known as the Uniting for Peace Resolution. It allows special meetings of the entire membership to be called when the UN Security Council is deadlocked on an issue and cannot exercise its mandate to maintain or restore international peace and security, in this case, because of Russia's veto. Monitors said Monday about 20 people in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo were killed in an attack by the suspected Allied Democratic Forces rebel group. According to the Kivu security tracker, the victims were civilians in the Kakura village in Beni territory on Sunday night. Ricardo Rupande, head of a local association of grassroots groups, gave the same toll and urged the armed forces to take action against the rebels. The ADF has been blamed for thousands of deaths in eastern DRC, as well as a spate of recent bomb attacks in the Ugandan capital. Via remote, I'm Liz Palka, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, March 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. sends additional weapons to Ukraine as Russian forces intensify efforts to break Kyiv's resistance.
A U.S. senior defense official said that he was confident that the shipments were getting to where they need to go, but he did not want to go into details as to how the U.S. was getting the shipments across.
The U.S. expels a dozen Russian diplomats for engaging in activities incompatible with their status.
We had a statement from the U.S. mission to the United Nations from the spokesperson there, and she said that they've abused residency in the United States by engaging in espionage activities.
And FIFA suspends all Russian teams from all international soccer, including qualifying matches for the 2022 World Cup. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. As Ukraine forces battle to beat back a large-scale Russian offensive on the fifth day of their invasion, the United States is sending additional lethal military capabilities, including anti-tank and air defense weapons. This as the first round of talks aimed at stopping the fighting between Ukraine and Russia ended Monday with no agreement except to keep talking. An increasingly isolated Moscow has run into unexpected fierce resistance on the ground and economic havoc at home, while Ukraine is moving to solidify its ties to the West by applying to join the European Union. For more on the Pentagon's plans, I spoke with VOA's Carla Bob.
U.S. officials are being very quiet about specific shipments that are going in because they don't want to telegraph to the Russians exactly what the Ukrainians are receiving. That said, a U.S. senior defense official spoke to reporters and said that he was confident that the shipments were getting to where they need to go, but he did not want to go into details as to how the U.S. was getting the shipments across. I pressed that defense official. I said, is there some sort of collaboration going on between the U.S. and NATO and other allies trying to get equipment and weapons and other aid to Ukrainians? The official said that as far as he was aware, there had not been a collaborative effort on this. However, he said the U.S. was focused on getting its assistance into Ukraine. It had been successful in doing so. And should it be needed to help with other countries, should they ask for help, the U.S. was willing to give some help in getting that aid to the Ukrainians as well.
What is the overall assessment of the Pentagon on the ongoing battle for Kyiv and other cities in Ukraine?
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby just told reporters that you have to hand it to the Ukrainians. They have set back the Russians. The Russians are not moving as quickly as they expected. They've hit a bunch of hurdles. In fact, they've hit Ukrainian resistance, for one, the military, the civilians. There's been a lot of resistance in Ukraine. And they've also hit logistical hurdles as well. You can just go to social media and you can see Russian tanks that have been taken over because they ran out of gas. You have seen rows of Russian tanks being taken out by air weapons. I don't know if they were drones. I don't know specifically what the air weapon was, but you can see that they were taken out as well as they're trying to get to these major city areas. And the important things to know from a military perspective are two things. One, the Russians do not have control of any of the major cities in Ukraine, and we're on day five. And two, the Russians still do not have control of Ukrainian airspace. That was a big concern for the United States, NATO, and others because Russia is a massive military power, and they have a lot of air capabilities. So the fact that the Ukrainians have been able to resist and keep the Russians away from air superiority over their skies has been a critical factor as well.
Yesterday, alarm bells went off all over Europe, all over the world, when the Russian president placed his nuclear forces on alert. How worried is the Pentagon?
Well, the Pentagon is very clear. They would not talk about the Russian capabilities, the Russian changes, or their own nuclear capabilities, only to say that the U.S. is ready to deter any nuclear threat that would threaten NATO. So that is a very clear way of saying that the U.S. does have in position means to counter any sort of Russian nuclear threat. That said, that response just did not seem like something that would come from a normal, clear-thinking human being. The way that the president of Russia phrased that. He talked about the sanctions that NATO and the West were putting against Russia in basically the same thought process as putting a special alert on his nuclear forces. I've been speaking to officials and they say they don't exactly know what that means. They don't want to talk about any movements that they're seeing with that, but that is very concerning for the West because the nuclear threat has always been something that is a deterrent. It's to prevent major military powers from going to war with each other. So the thought of actually using that deterrent offensively is something that the U.S. and the West, I think, might have been caught a little by surprise and is starting to make more people wonder what exactly is Putin's calculus in all of this.
What is the update of American forces around the region? And how confident is the Pentagon, the defensive capabilities of countries around the same area where all this is going on?
The U.S. is sending an additional 7,000 troops to Europe. Those troops are going to be reassuring NATO allies. So some of them are going to be going to Europe, potentially for the use in what's called a NATO response force, should NATO decide to activate a force that's 40,000 strong in order to better defend its territories. I asked Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby if the U.S. had received additional requests from NATO allies, the U.S. to unilaterally supply additional troops along countries in the eastern flank. He said no request to discuss at this time, but he said don't rule out future deployments in the coming days.
That's VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob speaking with me from Washington. U.S. and Russian officials say the United States has expelled 12 Russian diplomats at the United Nations over national security concerns. The U.S. mission to the United Nations described the Russian diplomats as, quote, intelligence operatives, unquote, who had been engaging in espionage activities that are adverse to our national security, unquote. Russia's UN ambassador Vasily Nabenzia described the U.S. move as, quote, hostile, unquote, and a violation of its commitment as host of the UN headquarters in New York, unquote. U.S. Deputy UN Ambassador Richard Mills responded that the diplomats have been asked to leave the United States. They were engaging in activities that were not in accordance with their responsibilities and obligations as diplomats, unquote. The United States and its allies have already slapped sweeping economic sanctions on Moscow for its attack on Ukraine. For more, I spoke with VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
We had a statement from the U.S. mission to the United Nations from the spokesperson there, and she said that they've abused residency in the United States by engaging in espionage activities that are adverse to our national security. We heard the news actually first from Russia's U.N. ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, who was holding a news conference on the situation in Ukraine when he received a phone call during the press conference, and it was someone from his mission telling him that the United States had just delivered a letter to them informing them of the decision to expel the 12 diplomats, and they have until next week, until March 7th, to leave the country. So he's calling it a hostile action by the U.S. government. He said it violates their obligations as the host country of the United Nations. And he said, you know, everyone's always telling us to do diplomacy, but how can we do it if you limit our opportunities to do it? So a new round in the latest deterioration of U.S.-Russian relations.
What about the Ukrainian invasion by Russian forces? Is there any development on that front?
The U.N. General Assembly action has moved there this week. We're having a lengthy debate. It'll go for a few days until probably Wednesday. Nations, mostly supportive of Ukraine, are speaking about the situation in Ukraine, about how Russia's actions have violated the UN Charter, and they are calling for an end to the hostilities and talks and such. And there's going to be a vote probably Wednesday on a draft resolution in the General Assembly that calls for a halt to the fighting and a withdrawal of Russia's forces and return to negotiations.
Any scenario where China is likely to support this resolution? Because it's been one of the main powers holding out.
They did express today concern that the situation is going in a direction they're not happy with. But at the same time, they're extremely close to Moscow. And I think they're very unlikely to support a resolution like this in the General Assembly. But don't forget, there's no vetoes in the General Assembly. Everybody's vote is equal. And the best case scenario would be where they abstain in a vote there.
That's VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from New York. The UN Human Rights Council has overwhelmingly approved a request to hold an urgent debate later this week on the crisis in Ukraine stemming from the Russian invasion of that country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The proposal was approved by 29 countries in the 47-member council. 13 countries abstained, and 5, China, Cuba, Eritrea, Russia, and Venezuela, voted against the proposal. The vote took place after an impassioned plea by Yevhenia Filipenko, Ukrainian ambassador to the UN in Geneva. She called on the Council to hold Russia accountable for what she called an unprovoked, unjustified attack on her country. In just 4 days, she said, the toll of destruction in Ukraine has become devastating. She said 352 people, including 16 children, have been killed, and some 1,700 people have been wounded, including 160 children. She said Russian bombing of civilian infrastructure, roads, and bridges has left hundreds of thousands of people without electricity and water and cut off communications.
Russian forces attempt to sow panic among the population by specifically targeting kindergartens and orphanages, hospitals, and mobile medical aid brigades, thus committing acts that may amount to war crimes. And Ukraine has filed the case against Russia in the International Court of Justice to bring Russia to account.
The Russian ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Gennady Gatilov, accused Ukraine of committing multiple atrocities against people living in Ukraine's southeastern Donetsk and Luhansk regions. He speaks through an interpreter.
Before us, we have nothing other than the usual attempt of Kiev to distract attention, the attention of the international community, away from what they have been doing for nearly 8 years now, which is a targeted destruction of completely innocent people in Donetsk and Lugansk, women, children, and the elderly.
Since 2014, more than 14,000 people in Donetsk and Luhansk have been killed in fighting between Russian-backed separatists and Ukrainian government forces. Russian President Vladimir Putin recognized the independence of the two rebel republics a week ago. Western governments condemned this action. They said Putin's decision to send so-called peacekeepers to safeguard the sovereignty and independence of the separatist region was a pretext to invade Ukraine. The Human Rights Council opened a 5-week session Monday. It has decided to hold the urgent debate on the situation of human rights in Ukraine stemming from the Russian aggression on Thursday. This follows a 3-day high-level segment with the participation of heads of state and other dignitaries from more than 140 countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the sanctions that followed has pushed the price of oil to over $100 per barrel, the highest level in 8 years. It's also opened an opportunity for African oil producers like Nigeria, Angola, Libya, and Algeria to cash in with more crude oil exports. But a lack of refineries in Africa means crude oil exporters will have to pay more for imported fuels. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Crude oil prices hit $105 per barrel last week, the highest mark since 2014, and up by 47% since December, amid fears that supplies from Russia may be impacted by its war with Ukraine. Russia accounts for about 10% of the world's crude oil output, making it the third biggest producer globally behind the United States and Saudi Arabia. But experts say the Ukraine invasion and the sanctions slapped on Russia by Europe and the United States could significantly reduce demand for Russian products and increase the demand for Africa's. Isaac Boti is a public finance expert in Abuja.
For Africa, it's a kind of game we can look into. It's an opportunity. It presents that window of opportunity for African countries to see how they can increase their production capacity and meet the needs of the global demand of crude.
Nigeria is Africa's largest producer of oil at about 1.9 million barrels a day, followed by Libya, Angola, and Algeria. That positions those countries to reap windfall profits from rising oil prices. But economic analyst Paul Enyim notes that Nigeria will have to pay on the other end for finished products like gasoline.
At the end of the day, it's going to hit on our economy. We may think, you understand, we will gain. Perhaps oil prices will go up because of the crisis here and there. But hey, remember, we don't refine our crude oil.
All of Nigeria's refineries were shut down in 2020 because of money and maintenance issues and have yet to reopen. the country now depends entirely on imports to meet its fuel needs. For weeks, Nigeria has been battling to increase its national fuel supply after authorities recalled millions of liters of tainted imported petrol from circulation, causing a major shortage in West Africa's most populous nation. In contrast, Algeria, which does have refineries, said this week that it would supply Europe with petroleum products if necessary. But it says it's a good example for other African nations.
We need to develop our capacity to produce locally. We need to concentrate on our industrialization policies and see how we can expand this base. We need to look at various trade agreements that are existing.
As Russia's war on Ukraine persists, experts say the shift in focus on Africa could be both a blessing and a burden. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
In other news, Russian teams have been suspended from all international soccer, including qualifying matches for the 2022 World Cup, as Moscow was pushed towards pariah status in sports after its invasion of Ukraine. World soccer body FIFA and the European authority UEFA banned Russian national and club teams from their competitions, quote, until further notice, unquote, taking Russia's men's national team out of World Cup qualifying playoffs in 3 weeks' time. The high-level punishment involving sports and politics came after the International Olympic Committee pushed dozens of sports governing bodies to exclude Russian athletes and officials from international events. The IOC said this was needed to, quote, protect the integrity of global sports competitions and for the safety of all the participants, unquote. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Human rights activists accused China of detaining more than a million people in Xinjiang's internment camps. Sanjay Kamidov spoke to some who survived the camp and fled to the U.S. Anna Rice narrates his story.
This Islamic school in the Washington, D.C. suburb of Fairfax, Virginia, is open again after a COVID-induced quarantine. Many of the children who attend are immigrants from a region in China known as Xinjiang. They are Uyghurs, members of a Muslim ethnic group that live in Xinjiang. Here, children are taught the Uyghur language and literature, as well as the basics of the Islamic religion and Turkic history and culture. Almost every student in this school has family in Xinjiang. They say their relatives are either in detention camps or have died. These are portraits of their relatives and loved ones. They say all of them are still either in camps or unaccounted for. And they accuse Chinese authorities of persecuting all ethnic minorities in Xinjiang, not just Uyghurs, but also Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and Uzbeks. Beijing denies the existence of detention camps in China. The Chinese government calls the facilities housing Uyghurs in Xinjiang vocational training schools or educational centers. The authorities emphasize these re-education measures are aimed at combating extremism and terrorism. But this policy is actually aimed at forcing assimilation, says Rutgers University law professor NG Abdelkader.
Individuals who are viewed by the authorities as not adhering to this policy of conformity have been detained in internment camp. And currently there's at least 1 million Uyghur Muslims detained in internment camp. That Beijing has euphemistically named these internment camps as counterterrorism centers.
Some who survived the camps and managed to flee to the U.S. have testified before Congress more than once about their experience. 44-year-old Tursunay Ziyawudun, who's ethnically Uyghur, says she was arrested twice by police and spent over 10 months in a detention camp. Many of her cellmates were arrested for practicing Islam.
In the camp, I learned that most of the people were incarcerated for no reason. They have been arrested for praying, reading Quran, wearing hijab scarves, in general for practicing Islam.
Inside the camp, Tursunay and all her cellmates were under 24/7 video surveillance.
We were not allowed to speak our native tongue in the camp. We could not say the word Xinjiang. We were immediately corrected. There is no Xinjiang, there is only the Republic of China.
Right groups, including Human Rights Watch, estimate over 1 million people are being held in Xinjiang camps. In the meantime, Uyghur children at this school in Fairfax are learning a traditional Uyghur dance. They are enjoying the freedom they have found in the U.S. to be who they are, Uyghurs and Muslims, a freedom that does not exist for their relatives in China. For Sanjar Hamidov in Fairfax, Virginia, NRI's VOA News.
An expert group of 270 climate scientists warned the dire impacts of climate change soon will be irreversible unless governments act decisively to tackle these imminent global threats. Lisa Schlein again reports for VOA on the launch of the latest report by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
IPCC's chairman, Ho-Sung Lee, does not mince words. He says the stakes of our planet have never been higher.
Human activities have warmed the climate at a rate not seen in at least the past 2,000 years. We are on course to reaching global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius within the next two decades. And temperature will continue to rise unless the world takes much bolder action.
He says the action governments take today will shape how people will be able to adapt to climate change and how nature will respond to increasing climate risks. Deborah Roberts is co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2, which produced the report. She says the scientific evidence that climate change is a threat to human well-being and the health of the planet is unequivocal.
Climate change combines with unsustainable use of natural resources, habitat destruction, deforestation, and growing urbanization, as well as inequity and marginalization. 3.3 to 3.6 billion people live in global hotspots of high vulnerability to climate change.
These include parts of Africa, as well as South Asia, Central and South America, small islands, and the Arctic. The report warns people living in these hotspots will likely experience severe food shortages leading to malnutrition should global temperatures rise by 2 degrees Celsius by 2050. Despite these dire predictions, scientists say the report presents a reality check on what has been done to stem global warming and what remains to be done. They say the report offers solutions on how to adapt to climate change and mitigate their worst effects. Scientists say some challenges can be addressed by creating a more equitable and sustainable world, by moving away from fossil fuels to renewable energy, and by using indigenous knowledge to protect nature. These steps, along with adaptation and mitigation projects, can help create change, but poorer countries will need wealthier countries to help finance them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Basketball Africa League is back. Voice of America joins forces with Africa's premier men's basketball league to bring you the second season of the BAL. It is game on March 5th, 2022. 38 games, 12 teams leaving it all on the court in Senegal, Egypt, and Rwanda to determine the 2022 season champion. Tune in to VOA 24/7, FMs, and to our radio and TV affiliates for some action. Pre-game, play-by-play, post-game, daily highlights, delivered by our finest commentators. Basketball Africa League 2022 on Voice of America. May the best team win.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Ofor in Washington, wishing you a great day.
the voice of America. Washington, ba 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 zip.